The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Just sit tight. Broken, battered, and trapped in a ravine for days, a desperate driver wonders, "Will anyone find me?" by Melody Wren. The radio was playing as Michael Cabaloo headed out of Victoria, British Columbia, on an impulsive late-night drive last November. Above him, stars twinkled. He passed the community of Sook and continued west on Highway 14. Few people live along this stretch, which winds through miles of forest and brush along the southern coast of Vancouver Island. Road conditions were excellent. And then suddenly, they weren't. As Michael came around a bend, he plunged into a fog bank so dense he could no longer see the edge of the highway. The next thing he knew, his 1987 Toyota van had veered off the asphalt and was careening down a 45-degree hillside, crashing through bushes, past saplings, and over old logging debris. Ahead lay a cliff overlooking the Strait of Juan de Fuca. He knew if he went over that, his body might never be found. But his descent stopped abruptly with a massive thud as he slammed into a large stump. The front of the van cracked. The entire vehicle pitched to one side. And Michael, who wasn't wearing a seatbelt, got catapulted sideways. He smacked his head against the steering wheel and landed on the passenger side floor, under the dashboard, in shock and in pain. I've known Michael Cabaldew for more than 50 years. We met in high school in Ontario, where I still live. In his early 20s, he headed out west and settled on Pender Island, a 40-minute ferry ride from Victoria, and found work as a builder and carpenter. In recent years, he also set up a successful business growing greenhouse vegetables and flowers. At 68 years old, Michael had stayed true to his youthful hippie dreams. He still has long hair and a full beard, both now white, and he's still working as a builder and a greenhouse operator. But in March 2023, X-rays revealed a tumor on his spine. By that November, 8 months of chemo treatment had taken their toll. At 5 feet tall and down to only 88 pounds, he was weaker than he'd been at any point in his life. The drugs also left his bones brittle. As a result, he was recovering from a broken arm and a fractured knee caused by a recent slip on his driveway. "I don't bounce like I used to. I break now," he told me. On top of that, the cancer was playing havoc with his blood sodium levels, making it hard for him to think clearly. In retrospect, he says, that might have contributed to his decision to take his fateful drive. Michael had a hospital appointment in Victoria scheduled for the morning of Friday, November 10. So on Thursday, he took the ferry from Pender Island. Initially, he'd planned to have dinner with friends, so he picked up a lamb dinner and some sushi to bring with him. But when he considered the logistics, a 3-hour drive followed by another ferry, he thought better of it. Instead, he caught a movie in Victoria, and then, because it was a beautiful night, he decided to take a little drive. Now Michael was 145 feet down an embankment, crumpled shoulder down in a fetal position in the passenger side footwell. His nose was broken, and his face was a mess of blood. Although he didn't know it then, he'd also re-injured his fractured knee, fractured the other knee, and cracked his rib cage. The next few hours passed in a haze. When daylight arrived and he regained full consciousness, he decided that he needed to move. He had room to maneuver because he'd removed the passenger seat earlier to do work on the vehicle. But every attempt to shift position was agony. Over the next 6 hours, Michael took it one tiny movement at a time. Bit by bit, he methodically leveraged himself up until he was sitting on the engine cover next to the driver's seat. Outside, it was pouring. By sundown on Friday, he'd managed to navigate over the gear stick and brake lever into the relative comfort of the driver's seat. He jammed a cushion under his right buttock to counter the angle of the van and ate a few miniature chocolate bars. Then, worn out by the exertion, he fell asleep. By dawn on Saturday, as the rain eased up, Michael contemplated his situation. Driving out wasn't an option, nor was getting up to the highway under his own steam. Thanks to the angle of the van and the injuries he'd sustained, just opening a door and clambering out of the vehicle seemed an insurmountable challenge, never mind climbing up 145 feet of steep, rugged terrain. He'd have to rely on being rescued. But that wouldn't be easy. Michael could hear cars whizzing past on the road above. But even if passersby happened to glimpse his vehicle amid the shoulder-high brush, apparently abandoned, they wouldn't be able to see anyone inside. He had no cell phone. Michael had never seen the point of getting one. No one knew he'd taken an unplanned drive out of Victoria, so they'd have no reason to look for him here. And he couldn't honk to get the attention of drivers on the highway. In the 19 years that he'd owned his van, the horn had never worked. On the plus side, he was dry, at least for the most part. It was cold in the van, but he had an extra fleece, ironically emblazoned with, "Live the adventure, live the dream." To sustain himself, he had the contributions he'd picked up for his proposed get-together with friends. A whole braised lamb dinner with roasted veggies for three, securely packaged in foil. The accompanying sushi was now inedible, scattered all over the floor of the van, but he had a bag of mini chocolate bars he'd bought at the movie theater. To drink, he had one water bottle, half a bottle of Gatorade, and some cold coffee in a thermos. He apportioned out his stash of tiny O. Henry and Mars bars and switched on his hazard lights, hoping someone would spot him from the highway above. It was a false hope. He didn't realize that the rear lights weren't working, because his off-road descent had ripped the wires off the van's undercarriage. Back on Pender Island, his partner, Linda Dean, got a call from the hospital on Friday morning, telling her that Michael had missed his appointment. She started calling friends, asking if anyone had seen him. No one had. When he didn't come home that night, her concern grew. On Saturday, she contacted the police, urging them to search on high alert because of Michael's fragile medical state. Word of his disappearance quickly spread. I got a text from a mutual friend asking if I'd heard the news. I was actually scheduled to fly out to visit Michael a few days from then. Instead, I was anxiously waiting to hear whether my friend was alive or dead. In the van, Michael focused on survival. To keep his mind occupied, he talked to himself. He mulled over different business ideas to make money once he was rescued, like creating a line of specialized, loose-fitting clothing for old people that's easy to get in and out of. He'd called it Grouchy Grandpa Gear. He slept sporadically, and although chemo had left him without a lot of appetite, he knew he had to eat. The bite-sized chocolate bars looked most appealing, so he gradually worked his way through those. By Saturday afternoon, he decided he needed a strategy to attract attention. He hit on the idea of lighting a fire. People might not spot the fan, but they would see the smoke. Thanks to his construction work, he had some lumber in the van. He spent Saturday and Sunday, both wet, dismal days, collecting whatever wood and paper he could find in the cockpit of the van. He rolled down the driver's window, stacked the flammable material outside among the shrubs of Scotch broom, and struck a match. I was trying to catch the whole hillside on fire so someone would notice, he said. Instead, rain started pouring down, dousing the flame before a fire could get going. A second attempt was equally unsuccessful. At this point, early Sunday evening, he'd also finished his ration supply of liquids. Parched, he remembered British adventurer Bear Grylls' survival tip of drinking your own urine. He peed into the empty Gatorade bottle and swirled the liquid around in his mouth. "It tasted like you imagine it would," he said. "I swallowed one swig, but I knew I wasn't that close to death." Instead, Michael focused his attention back on the challenge of lighting a fire. If he couldn't succeed at the front of the van, he'd try the back, where the hatchback door would provide shelter from the rain. Getting there was a 2-day endurance test through an obstacle course of lumber and carpentry tools. "That's when I hit on the quarter of an inch mantra," he said. Every movement produced jolts of pain, but if he broke his task down into small enough movements, he might reach his goal. Where he could, he shifted obstructions enough to clear a path as he slowly crawled forward. When objects wouldn't budge, he rolled onto his back and inched himself over them. En route, he took advantage of the condensation that had formed on the windows. His first attempt to squeegee it off with the edge of a business card simply wiped it onto the floor. He learned to move the card slowly and deliberately, and then soak up the liquid with restaurant napkins and squeeze it into a takeout cup. It was about an ounce of water, and it tasted so delicious, he recalls. Michael arrived at the back of the van on Tuesday morning, armed with all the paper he had left to burn, last year's income tax receipts. The sun had come out, and he figured this was his last chance to signal for help. He reached for the rear door handle and tried to turn it, but it didn't budge. That's when he realized the door was locked on the outside, with a bolt he'd installed himself to keep the ancient door secure. It had taken him 2 days to remember that. Almost 108 hours after his van had left the road, 4.5 days, Michael hit his lowest point. He'd consumed his supplies of food and water. The freezing nights had started to take a physical toll, and he was running out of options. Should he try crawling up to the road? That seemed suicidal. But the thought of spending a fifth night in the van filled him with misery. Then, above him on the hillside, he heard voices. At the top of the embankment, at about 1 p.m. on Tuesday, Ethan Nesbitt and Will Mendham, 2 University of Victoria students on day 3 of a 4-day bike camping trip, had stopped for a lunch break. They took a moment to admire the sun reflecting off the strait, and beyond that, the Olympic mountain range in Washington State. That's when they noticed a van partway down the slope below them. They assumed someone was living in it, but when they saw it was stuck in deep vegetation, they decided to investigate. As they picked their way down through the thorn bushes and scotch broom, they started calling, "Is anyone there?" Michael responded, "Help!" Mendham reached the van first. When he unbolted the rear hatch door and lifted it up, he found a figure inside in rough shape, shaking, cold, and underdressed, and what clothes he had on were stained in blood. The men gave Michael their jackets and a wool hat and tried to call 911. Reception was spotty, so Mendham ran up to the road and flagged down a couple in a passing car. Fortunately, they had cell service. The 911 operator told Mendham it would take about 40 minutes for responders to arrive. So he grabbed a water bottle and some dried apricots from their bike packs and brought them to the van. Michael barely had enough energy to lift his own head, so Nesbitt cradled it as Michael drank and savored the fruit. After half an hour, a paramedic arrived, followed by an ambulance and a fire truck. The rescuers put Michael on a stretcher and used electric saws to carve out a path through the vegetation. It took everyone present, 7 first responders, Nesbitt, Mendham, and the couple who'd made the 9/11 call, to haul him up the steep slope, stumbling over countless roots, stumps, and logs. 2.5 hours after the cyclist found Michael, he was driven to a waiting helicopter and then airlifted to Victoria General Hospital. There he was cleaned up, warmed, and reunited with Linda, who gave him hell for not letting her know where he was going. A battery of x-rays, CT scans, EEGs, and other assessments revealed his numerous fractures, but his doctors told him they would heal without surgery. 4 days later, he was discharged. In early December, I met up with Michael at the Empress Hotel, overlooking the Victoria Harbor. We gathered with Linda, Michael's sister Wendy Stoll, and two high school friends in the hotel's colonnaded tea room. Michael sat in a wheelchair, looking frail. The suit he'd donned for the occasion hung off him. Still, he beamed, joyful to be surrounded by old friends. Servers set three-tiered arrays of finger sandwiches, scones, and pastries in front of us. In the background, a pianist played the grand piano as we sipped tea from fine china cups. It was a world away from the 4.5 days he'd recently spent trapped in his van. "I'm glad it happened," Michael told me as he savored the feast. "The ordeal gave him time to reflect on his life," he said, "and he'd come to terms with his own mortality. Physically, he still had a few aches, but his body was healing, and his sense of humor had survived intact. I'm okay in places," he said, "and I am moving slightly faster than 1/4 inch at a time." That was Just Sit Tight by Melody Wren. Now a second article, A Flag for Dad. An old sailor made a last wish. His son was determined to see that it came true. By Joseph C. Duckworth. July 4, 1995, should have been a happy day for me. It was not only our nation's birthday. It was mine as well. I turned 45 that day. But it was also the day my father died. In a week prior to his death, my wife Pat and I visited my parents. While Mom and Pat chatted, Dad and I did the same. At 77, he wasn't well, suffering from diabetes and congestive heart failure. After some small talk, Dad looked into my eyes and said, "Joe, my road is short. I'll be leaving here soon." The words hurt, but I tried not to show it. Then he came to the point, as was his way. He wanted a casket draped with an American flag. "That right," he said, "is due every American service member." And he wanted his burial flag to be one that had flown over an aircraft carrier. Dad was a quiet, unassuming man who had raised his 6 children on a factory worker's salary. But among his proudest memories was serving in the South Pacific during World War II, as an electrician's mate aboard the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill, CV-17. Dad never spoke about the battles he'd seen. He preferred to talk about the camaraderie and the friends he had made, and the pranks they had pulled on one another. Dad always liked a good prank. I told him I'd see to it. Dad smiled and changed the subject. It was an easy promise to make, but not so easy to fulfill. I could buy a flag, but it would never have flown over an aircraft carrier. No, it wouldn't do. That afternoon, I called the local Navy recruiter's office and spoke with an officer. I explained Dad's wish. He couldn't help me, but he suggested I call my congressman. I did, and spoke with a receptionist at the congressman's local office, telling her that my father was very ill and that he had requested an aircraft carrier flag for his casket. She told me I would need to speak directly with the congressman. She asked me for my phone number and said she would ask him to return my call. The phone rang less than an hour later. First and foremost, the congressman offered his condolences in advance. Then he said he would be honored to help and that he would keep us in his prayers. He gave me the name and telephone number of an admiral at the naval base in Norfolk, Virginia. The congressman asked me to please keep him informed and to call his Washington, D.C. office directly if we needed anything else. After we hung up, I called the telephone number in Norfolk, which apparently was the admiral's personal line, because he answered the phone himself. I identified myself and said my congressman had given me this direct number. I told him my father had served in World War II on an aircraft carrier. I told him my dad was terminally ill and had made his wishes known to me, an American flag that had flown over an aircraft carrier to drape over his casket at the funeral. "Can you help me?" I asked the admiral. In the gravelly voice of an old salt, he bellowed, "Now you listen to me, young man. Those brave people who served in World War II kept us free. This is one admiral in the United States Navy who intends to see to it that those old sailors receive the honor and gratitude of our country. I'll give you the name and telephone number of a captain here at Norfolk Naval Base. You call him and tell him I said to get you an aircraft carrier flag in the mail today." Calming down, he asked on which aircraft carrier Dad had served. "The Bunker Hill, CV-17, I said. There was a brief silence. Then the admiral said he knew some of the history of that old carrier. "Kamikazes," he said softly. "Two of them. It was bad. I'm telling you, your dad's flag will be on the way to you today." Then he asked me to call him again if there was any delay. I thanked him profusely. "No, son, I thank you. You've given me the opportunity to thank that old sailor and provide him with the flag of our country. He deserves it, and I intend for him to have his flag." I immediately called the captain and told him the admiral had given me his name and telephone number. I then explained Dad's impending death and request for an aircraft carrier flag to drape over his casket. The captain asked for my address and told me that these requests are not unusual. He said he would see to it today that an aircraft carrier flag was on the way to me. 2 days later, Dad's flag arrived. We went to see Dad and Mom that afternoon. I showed Dad his aircraft carrier flag, which was accompanied by a personal letter from the captain, thanking him for his service to our country. Dad smiled, thanked me, and held the American flag lovingly in his hands. I could swear I saw tears in that tough guy's eyes. At 2:43 p.m. on July 4, Independence Day, Dad gained his independence from pain and suffering. On the day of his funeral, the American flag, which had flown over an aircraft carrier, draped Dad's casket. As taps played, the flag was trifolded and presented to my mother. Dad never sought attention, but that day was all about him. We honored him as a husband, a father, and a grandfather. And thanks to that flag, as a sailor in the United States Navy. That was A Flag for Dad by Joseph C. Duckworth. And now a third article, shorter, A Crash Course in Cranberries. Time to Put the Side Dish Front and Center by Emily Tyra. Some cooks will insist on making their own cranberry sauce, laden with plump whole berries and ingredients like honey or orange zest. Others swear solely by the stuff in a can. Americans in the latter camp consume more than 5 million gallons of jellied cranberry sauce each year, just between Thanksgiving and Christmas. While 68% of Americans say they love the taste, another 15% just love the way it jiggles. If you've ever seen a slippery cylinder of jellied cranberries wriggle out of its can, you'll recognize what Farmer's Almanac aptly describes as the satisfying whoosh flop. The man who first crammed cran into a can was New Englander Marcus L. Uran. In 1912, wanting to extend the berry's short-selling season, he developed a sauce that could be preserved in big batches. He sold his jellied concoction under the name Ocean Spray Preserving Company. Later, he joined forces with two competitors to form a cooperative that today comprises more than 700 family farmers. As one of only a handful of native fruits cultivated in North America, cranberries were an important indigenous food source. Vitamin C and antioxidants, especially anthocyanins and flavanols, give the tart berries their dark crimson hue. Native American tribes from the Cape Cod Pequots to the South Jersey Lenni Lenape and farther west to the Algonquins of Wisconsin culled cranberries in the wild from low, long-running vines within bogs and marshes. Bogs are one of North America's most distinctive types of wetlands, spongy beds with thick moss, acidic waters, and peat deposits. The North American cranberry harvest kicks into high gear every autumn, with the top-producing state, Wisconsin, producing around 60% of the annual U.S. crop. Massachusetts, the second-largest producer, is home to the oldest continuously cultivated cranberry beds. Some vines are more than 150 years old. Iconic images of farmers wading in knee-high, ruby-red seas of cranberries propagate a popular myth. The cranberries grow in water. In fact, they have air pockets that allow them to float. So the night before the berries are ready to harvest, growers flood the bog. The next day, they churn the water with giant water reels, or egg beaters, to shake the fruit from their vines. Then, crews wade in and corral the bobbing berries with large brooms. These cranberries are considered wet harvested, and are used mostly for juice drinks and sauces. About 200 cranberries get squeezed into each can of sauce. Dry harvesting, by contrast, yields fruit that is sold fresh in the produce aisle. In this case, a mechanical picker gently combs the berries off the vines and deposits them into burlap sacks, often to await a helicopter that swoops in and airlifts the berries out of the bog. How's that for a dramatic exit? Whether you stir up your own sauce, shimmy it out of a can, or simply want a serving of tableside trivia this Thanksgiving, our all-American cranberry is the answer. That was A Crash Course in Cranberries by Emily Tyra. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.